You are tuned in to the NTD Broadcast Network presentation of Off Camera with Sam Jones. The best conversations happen off camera.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I sit down with Blake Mills. After releasing two records with his former band, Simon Dawes, guitarist, producer, and songwriter Blake Mills went on to become a go-to touring guitarist and session musician for acts including Jenny Lewis, Band of Horses, Julian Casablancas, Fiona Apple, Connor Oberst, Kid Rock, Norah Jones, Lana Del Rey, and Danger Mouse. A lifetime of career experience for most musicians, it constitutes Mills' resume at just 26 years of age. Impressive, even given that he played his first gigs at age 13. In bars, but that's another story. Mills encompasses several rare dichotomies. A true intellectual and a pop rock musician. A supremely accomplished guitarist and also a songwriter to be reckoned with. And a virtuoso who doesn't let his virtuosity get in the way of making great music. Mills talks to Off Camera about how his autodidact approach informed his musical development. How today's musicians and fans are both helped and hurt by vast access to music online. How he escaped a career in football, and what he and some talented collaborators are doing, hosting public jam sessions in a surf shop. If Mills' name isn't more well-known, perhaps it's because he works pretty hard to remain low-key. That may just change with the growing popularity of his first solo album, Break Mirrors. So pull up a chair and listen in.
So Blake, thanks for coming in and doing this with me, and for agreeing to let me dig into your personal life a little bit. I want to start right away with your guitar playing, which is fascinating to me. And before I even knew who you were, I'd heard, oh, there's this guy, there's this new guy in town. He's getting all this session work, and guys that I know that are heavy players are like, I don't know, this Blake guy's coming in, I don't know if they're gonna call me anymore. And
putting the heat on me.
That's right. I mean, tell me, when did you kind of know that the guitar, was gonna be something that, took over your life?
When it became my out for having to play tackle football. Yeah, it was my escape from things that I really didn't want to do. And then by taking guitar seriously, or when I started to take guitar seriously, it encouraged my reasons, my procrastination, or my excuses for not wanting to do homework or suit up for football practice, or I could just zone out and go into the room of the house that had all the equipment in it, and go through a few hours without being bothered or having to feel bad about it, feel guilty, And it still is it's like my excuse for keeping unhealthy sleeping hours and not doing what I'm supposed to, or it's like my best friend, the bad influence.
You're right, but I mean, which I totally understand, but I also think that if it was something else, you found guitar, and although maybe it started out as an excuse, it also, clearly was something that you were incredibly attuned to from the beginning.
Well, it does help to feel like you have a fluency, it's that you understand and can communicate through something. It's like being able to speak a language confidently. To be able to conceptualize something and know how to access it on a guitar or any instrument, just in music, is pretty big, because the language is sort of universal. It's so big, and it's nice. It does feel like a little success every time that happens. Every time you're feeling something profound and you react to it musically, and somebody else then, you know, gets a similar feeling from it. It's kind of fascinating to me, you know, and for someone who you know, can't otherwise explain or communicate all the things that they would like to, it's a nice, easy way for me to emote, you know. And I'm not a particularly emotional guy, but I'm such a fan of emotional music. So maybe it's just sort of the outlet for some things that otherwise would probably just get sort of swept under the rug.
Do you remember a time when you're like, oh my God, I can really play this thing, and I'm, you know, something is opening up for me?
Well, I remember when it stopped. As a listener, it stopped being so much about the showiness of the instrument. Like, the guitar has such a history of flashy playing and trying to impress an audience, you know, with acrobatics or whatever. And I was impressed by it. I loved it. I was obsessed with Eddie Van Halen and Steve Vai and Yngwie Malmsteen, all the guys, and went through, you know, the ranks. And then at a certain point, I started spending more time and more serious time with records by Nina Simone and Donny Hathaway and Thelonious Monk and stuff that I guess would be characterized as, you know, more serious music by some. And it's just a different experience. It was a different listening experience. And I think that I sort of followed that, and I tried to figure that language out. And it became, for me, it's been a long time since I had any desire to be an impressive player. You know, I just want to be a moving player, you know, a moving musician. I'm much more fascinated with, you know, like I was saying, that idea of being able to touch somebody across the room, you know, without reaching over there. I think that's a little more mysterious and interesting because having people around that if there was some sort of incredible guitar lick or some run, something fast, you know, it was only a matter of somebody saying, yeah, it's actually just this. This is what it's like slowed down, and this is how you play it. The magic tricks were too easy to perform or to decipher.
We all, in our, you know, in our coming of age and our maturation as artists or whatever, go through our influences, and, you know, you definitely have to maybe take some paths that aren't going to be your final path. But I mean, I'm assuming you kind of found your own way, that you didn't have someone from the very beginning saying, listen to this, don't listen to this.
No, I didn't really have like a tastemaker, but I did have, I was surrounded by a lot of people who I grew up in Malibu, and I started playing music with a lot of people's kids, a lot of like musicians' sons, and so they had this lineage, they had this knowledge of some great music. I was in a band with Dickie Betts' son, Roy Orbison's son, and it was Barry Oakley Jr.'s son. It was just sort of like getting this sort of their pedigree rubbing off a little bit, just for those influences that you're talking about, and them saying, like, you know, I mean, that I remember somebody turning me on to Derek Trucks, and that really was a huge turning point, because at the time he was the most emotive player that I think I had ever heard. You know, maybe he and John Scofield, they both, their phrasing was so unique that it was like, okay, this is the echelon of, like, this is the extent that I've heard the instrument taken, and that's where I wanted to, that's what I wanted to figure out. I didn't necessarily think I was gunning to be in that like department, but I just wanted to figure out how those magic tricks were done. You know, I wanted to figure out what that was, what was different, you know, what they were doing. So I studied the kind of slide that Derek used and the gauge strings that Schofield was using, and you start to gain little bits of knowledge and stuff, but really I think it came down to trying to find interviews of them talking about what records they were listening to and where they were coming from. So growing up with the internet was kind of great. You had this big shared experiences with your idols, you know, because all of that history, all of those records are gettable. So you just go in 1 week, you've got this plethora of, you go to, I went down to the warehouse with a list, you know, the CD store with a list of stuff to pick up, you know, and came back with a big bag, you know, and then the downloading thing hit, and the music from, you know, weird countries of the world that I'd never heard of, that's just like, it kind of set off from there, and since it's just been this big kind of like, the pinata has broken and you're just trying to grab as much candy as you can in terms of listening to music and hearing stuff.
I'm a good bit older than you, and for me, discovering music was kind of, you know, you were lucky to hear one new album a month. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to rely on either yourself buying it or one of the kids in the neighborhood, and I can imagine it's amazing, but also overwhelming to like have all this at your disposal all the time. I mean, did you just disappear into your room and just did the time just go by without any understanding of, you know, eating or
it was hours and hours and hours on the Compaq computer, just on Kazaa, you know, just trying to grab as much stuff that I couldn't get on CD. I had always preferred to go and buy the CD because I loved to look at the pictures and read about who was playing and stuff, but there was a lot of stuff that wasn't gettable, and I had no you know, morals in regards to the ethics of downloading and just taking all this stuff because it was gettable. But it was pretty interesting to be able to read about, you know, to be reading an interview with a musician, them reference somebody, reference an author, reference another musician or a record, and to just practically click that and then be taken, you know, to exactly what they were talking about and be able to try to have that experience that they're talking about is something that I would be interested to know all the effects that it has on people, you know, that are from my generation. It's profoundly different than it seems like it has been for anybody that came before us. And I definitely think it has some effects, probably some detrimental ones. You know, I think that there's particularly less diligence now with a lot of musicians, you know, they see the results of years and years and years of work that somebody else has put in, and they become sort of fascinated with the results, but not with the process, not with who they were listening to or even what's necessarily going on, you know, like between the lines and under the surface of that stuff. So it's sort of like an immediacy, you know, that we were talking about. Like you could just click that name, you can click that record and go there. The same immediacy can be said to be a characteristic of a lot of writing and playing and record making, and you know, it's not really it's not always the best thing for creativity, you know, having all that stuff at your disposal.
I can't imagine being a writer now and having access to everything all the time. And how do you focus and concentrate? And
I guess I'm just aware of both sides. If it weren't the internet, maybe it would be something else. Maybe it would, you know, be a table tennis match with my neighbor or something. You know, for, I'm sure there was some vice for every generation, but I just try to make the vices now the most educational that they can be. You know, try not to. It's like I don't go to like tabloid sites or something, you know, something ridiculous like that. But it's definitely always there, and it does sometimes feel like the enemy of what I'm trying to do. You know, like that it'll take me away from my focus. But
speaking of writing, I want to talk about your first solo record that's been out for a few years now. But you know, I find you very interesting because you are a very accomplished guitar player who also can be a songwriter, and I think that doesn't happen that often. You either maybe are the brain that can be very musical and very improvisational, or you are the brain that can craft a story and put it to song. And I'm both impressed and fascinated by when I meet people who can do both. And so I have a few questions about your your first solo record, but before I ask any of them, maybe you can just briefly explain the name of the record and why it's called Break Mirrors.
The record is called Break Mirrors because that was the way that when I was touring in Japan with Band of Horses, the way that they pronounced my name, that our friends over there would say my name. I think one of the guys in the band pointed out that it was Break Mirrors. It was like, and we tried to figure out if like, you know, if they said the phrase Break Mirrors, if it would sound more like Blake Mills. And
well, I didn't get it at first. It took me a minute or two. And I first thought, well, this is like some sort of, you know, you break a mirror, it's 7 years of bad luck. And then I was like, oh, of course.
Right. Yeah, there's a few... there were definitely a few things that were done just for the humor or whatever. And then later on, they were given meanings by other people, you know. So now they have meanings. So now I've got like a backup, you know. Like yeah, like the break mirrors, the bad luck, the photo on the front not being of me but being of somebody who I related to just. That was a photo of a kid in a skate park that my friend took, and I really, really related to having the tank top on, being covered in filth after a day of skating, and like that exact condition, you know, like I was like, I've been there, and I related to him in the photo, and yet clearly this person was from a completely different reality. At a homemade Tupac Bic pen tattoo on his arm, and he was at a skate park in Ohio. And so the idea of like this being this kind of reflection of me, but in a sort of half sense or jagged sense, you know, the idea of like looking into a broken mirror. I mean, all these like probably really artistically weak metaphors could be drawn from all sorts of things on that record, but that they were actually just done for the good nature of the enjoyment of doing them.
Well, I mean, it does. It's a mysterious cover, and it it's almost like evokes some Gus Van Sant type of imagery or something like that. But one thing it does not do is that record does not scream, "I'm a guitar player." And
right.
It's kind of deceptively simple, and you know, the playing is beautiful, but it's. To me, it's not the main focus. Was that intentional on your part?
Kind of. I mean, it wasn't a concept. It was just that I felt totally fulfilled as a guitar player in everything that I was doing. I definitely, as a producer, looked at the whole thing, you know, as a project and an experiment. But I never sat with it as a guitar player and thought, like, how do I like fit myself as a player into this? You know, it just didn't. Looking back on it now, I don't even listen to it and think, oh, that would have been a good place for something. I mean, there's a couple little moves and there's slide and stuff, but although I wouldn't make the record, I wouldn't have that happen again. Like, I would really like to make another record and create more of an environment for to have some fun on guitar. I wouldn't do that one any differently. I think it was important for me to make that distinction. You know, I mean, I still think of myself as a guitar player before a songwriter. But I think if I hadn't put as much focus on the writing as I did on that record, if I had saved any of my attention for the guitar playing, I might not have felt like I got everything out of me as the writer on that.
Well, I find that, like a lot of great first works by people in any genre, it's very autobiographical. And it is, you know, there's a lot of stuff about your family in there, and it's, like I touched on earlier, it is emotional, and it's a very good communication about growing up and about, you know, kind of looking at the way your parents did things and the way you are going to do things, and I find that puts it on the level with great songwriting. Is that it's every song is really about something, and every song is a story, and it's kind of like you missed that whole phase where you just wanted to write songs and have rock and roll words or something. You know, it's a really autobiographical record.
That kind of autobiographical, almost uncomfortably revealing, but relatable songwriting was what I really responded to in a lot of the stuff that I was listening to, my favorite records at the time. And writers that I was working with on sessions and touring, and now it's interesting. Now I, after having maybe revealed a little more than is my comfort zone on that record, I've become really interested in like the songwriting styles of stuff that goes back a little earlier. Like the Gershwin brothers and or like the Ink Spots or something, you know, material that is it's emotionally profound, but lyrically a little sweeter and a little more general, sort of sentimental, but not as autobiographical. The kind of classicism.
Well, I think that the autobiographical thing is, you know, it's kind of where, if as an honest artist, it's where you have to start. You have to say, here's who I am.
Yeah. Right?
And I see that in a lot of artists. I mean, and you know, especially in a song like It'll All Work Out. You say, I'm sorry I didn't take the path you laid down. You also mentioned earlier playing guitar got you out of football practice. Did your father play football?
Well, he didn't play football. He may have played a little bit, but what he did was he started a Pop Warner football league when I was born in hopes that I would grow up and play and go through it. Which when I came of age, I started to, and I think I played for about 2 years, 2 or 3 years. And I had fun. I wasn't necessarily a bad player. I was a fullback, and I really liked I liked the contact of the sport. I liked to hit. I liked to be, you know, covered in pads and just run into a kid, you know, full speed. But what I didn't like was the regimen. I didn't like practice. I didn't like getting 4 hours of sleep, going to school, and then suiting up and going to practice 4 or 5 days a week. And I didn't relate at all to any of the kids that were teammates, and I started to resent it. So I just went full bore with, this is the worst thing in my life, and I hate it. You know?
What was his reaction when you kind of turned your back on football?
Yeah, he was a little bummed. He was a little bummed out. He was a little bummed out, but he was always supportive of and fascinated, it seemed, with my attachment to music and guitar. You know, I mean, he was the guy that drove me to and from the bar you know, like when I was 13, 14, he would drive me home at 2 in the morning.
So you were playing in bars when you were 13 or 14?
Yeah, and they, I couldn't get into them without my dad. As much as I wanted to be hanging around these guys and not have, you know, my family in tow, he was, you know, it's like the buddy system. It's like, yes, you can do it, but on one condition, you know. And there was a lot of, there was some recreational drug use taking place at the time, and I lost interest in that at a pretty young age, and so, and maybe having him around kind of enforced that, you know, it's like, it's sort of like it felt sometimes more like I was on a field trip, a school field trip, than like a teenage weekend romp or whatever, you know, whatever you'd call it.
Well, it's interesting though that, you know, he was there and it wasn't like something you had to go do in spite of your parents. He was still supportive, which I think is also
incredibly so. Yeah.
I was thinking also about, you talk about money struggles in It'll All Work Out, and it was pretty descriptive kind of snapshot of your family at a certain time in your life. And I wonder if that was difficult or hard for your dad to hear, or how that kind of, how that maybe affected your playing or the path you took.
I've just had to not think about it. I've had to try to put it out of mind, because I feel like in order to get the confidence to put some of those things in a song in the first place, you have to kind of cut the tether to the consequences a little bit. It's enough to have to play that song knowing that they're in the audience, and year after year, it takes a certain amount of like sort of just shutting off, because I don't think songs are, even if a song is about somebody, it's not a direct one-on-one communication with them. It's not even communicating with them per se. You're sort of waxing. It's like you're thinking out loud about the topic, about the person. And a lot of times the stuff that you think about aren't necessarily things that you would ever say to that person. So even though that song is largely about them, about my parents, obviously they're not things that I've ever said to them. They're not things that I feel like I ever need to say. They feel appropriate. They feel it appropriate to just come out and talk, you know, about face to face, bluntly with them. But they feel appropriate to explore creatively, you know, artistically, and they just I didn't have the tools to disguise it, you know, to like kind of vague them up a little bit, and they just kind of came out a little more bluntly than perhaps, you know, some of the people that talk about stuff like that.
Well, I'm happy that you didn't disguise it, because I feel like what you did was you created something universal by singing about something very specific and personal. And I think that song is it says that in a way that I haven't heard on record before. And by being so specific in the verses, you really get a sense of your, like, who you are. And I think that's the trick in songwriting, really, is... How do I create this record that really bears my soul, and then does it in a way that makes other people feel closer to their soul? I think mm-hmm. Neil Young was good at that, and, mm-hmm. Dylan, and that's why I'm so impressed with that record, and why I wanted to talk to you about it.
A friend of mine had a great tweet. He quoted somebody. I don't think he even cited the quote. Maybe it was his quote, but he said, why are we so concerned with shielding our children from the shitty world and less concerned with making it a less shitty world? I mean, it was more elegantly put, but the concept is is pretty strong. It's funny, but when you expose somebody for something that they've actually done, you know, there's more grounds for resentment than you know, telling a little fabrication or like, you know, adding more for the story.
But that's the beauty of this. You wrote it when you were young. You can say something when you're young and when your heart is on your sleeve and you're honest, and it works.
Yeah, you
it's
can
real.
Blame it on the hormones.
It seems as though guitar players are either kind of one or the other. Guys with chops, you know, who are virtuosos, or kind of original thinkers. But it's kind of rare to find both qualities in the same player sometimes. And I wonder if you have a few people that you look up to who kind of fit that quality and who you kind of maybe mentored yourself from a distance.
I mean, definitely more than a few. I agree. I think it's rare with guitar, maybe more so than other instruments, because there's an immediacy about guitar. It's compared to some other instruments. To me, it strikes me as a more playable instrument than some. It's easy to.
What do you mean by playable?
Well, it's easy to reproduce the things that you hear other people do with guitar. I mean, you've got infomercials of a guy with big, great long fingernails and a black Zorro hat who can show you how to play pretty much anything, you know? And they scroll the genres, you know, through the screen. It's not hard to access your favorite songs on guitar. To me, it's much less mysterious than like piano. I mean, piano, to be expressive on a piano, on an instrument where you can't really bend notes, and you've got this sort of like mechanical process that separates the action from the production of the sound. There are all these things that seem way more fascinating, but create a distance. Just inherently, with guitar, you kind of put your hands down anywhere. You can get great results just by accident. What got us on this subject? Remind me.
Well, I guess I was trying to ask if there was a moment when you realized you made the leap or crossed the bridge between an imitative player to an original player.
Oh, I mean, I still consider myself an imitative player, but maybe just less literal, you know, less of the trying to reproduce a lick or a sound or a tone. You know, you come across these players who found a way to sit amongst other instruments or other players, or figured out a way to approach a song, or approach a certain feeling on the instrument and obtain that. And to me, that's much more. That's the stuff that I sit down and try to figure out. I mean, the last record that I sat down to try to learn, to decipher, was the soundtrack to The Good, Bad, and the Ugly. And just trying to figure out how that guy got those lines, those electric guitar lines, to bite so hard, how he was picking it, and perhaps what gear he was using, and what, you know, like kind of positioning he was using to get some of these runs and these pull-offs and stuff, because it's such a feeling, it's such a style of playing that there's a discipline to it, but there's also a kind of like naivete to it. You know, he's not nailing it, he's not executing it perfectly. So what is it about the execution that is so rewarding? You know, if it's not just like the thorough, like, correctness, you know what I mean? Like, and there's such a lesson in that, in trying to figure out, what are these guys doing? What is it about Nina's vibrato And when she starts it, after she comes upon a note that is so intoxicating, you know what I mean? What separates her from the people who cover the song on American Idol or The Voice? You know, what is the margin? What's the difference? You know, and I think being able to learn from, you know, like history's mistakes, as they say, you know, and like to it's like studying, it's like trying to avoid, you know, the musical Holocaust, you know, like not to just appropriate the what these people have done and their sound, but to figure out what the anatomy of it is, to try to better understand it, seems like a totally worthwhile lesson to me.
You know, I spent some time in the studio recently watching you, and you often kind of chased your mistakes a little more than you chased where it wanted to go. In other words, it seemed like you may have stumbled across something, and you were trying to follow this path, but that stumble was more interesting to you. Mm. I find that fascinating because I think that happens across all the arts. I think that in photography, some of my favorite photographs are complete mistakes. And I wonder if there's a relatability in that, in guitar playing and songwriting.
Well, absolutely. I think in trying to revise, you know, in what I consider the revision process, it might just be more of a refinement of the unexpected, the mistakes, you know, the accidental, the accidental first thought, you know what I mean? It's like, it's what you end up doing when you're trying to, it's like that cheesy life is what happens to you when you're busy making other plans. I think John Lennon, cheesy guy.
Yeah, that old cheesy guy.
Yeah, I think it kind of pertains to that. It relates to that. You get this idea in your head and you set out to find it or to achieve it, maybe even conquer it. And if you can manage to be aware of what's happening while you're out there trying to go after it, I think that ends up being 99 times out of 100, much more compelling and interesting. You know, and it's like hearing people talk about the important thing, you know, being sort of like the path to get there, not the destination. I think it ends up, people could probably relate to it more, you know? Like, I don't think human goals, you know, like the end game, I don't think that's nearly as relatable as the path that, you know, that we take to get to where we're trying to go. I noticed that when I was making my record, talking about these experiences that seemed totally personal and unique to me was that's when I was at my most relatable to people. And I was also kind of trying to prove a point that even growing up in Malibu, in this like seemingly alternate reality to most of the rest of the country or the world, it's not that unusual. It's not that unique. It's certainly not what it's perceived to be. And that is the idea of being misunderstood. You know, who feels understood? You know, like, you know.
Right. Exactly. What makes a real songwriter? Like, it seems like there are the craftsmen, like the Cole Porters or the Brill Building people. And then there are these conduit guys who like claim that, you know, they just have to grab it out of the air when it happens and write it down all at once, like Neil Young or you know.
Well, I think they're both valid. I have been able to experience both sides of the sort of creative personalities because as a guitar player, as a musician, it's never been difficult to sit down and come up with a brand new idea, and it's not a cerebral process. It's not intellectual. It's just purely, it's muscle memory and it's familiarity and you know, going after some kind of like texture or some intangible thing, something a little bit more abstract, but I can sit and you know, a music will come out. It's like the reading about Bukowski sitting and just typing, you know. If I tried to sit and just type and write a song or approach lyrics that way, I couldn't even, you know, I couldn't get the word on a page. I couldn't get the first word out. So the writing, the songwriting is much more of a craft for me when it comes to the lyrics. There's a great book called Old Masters and Young Geniuses or something to that effect that talks about the creative personalities of some of the history's great artists that came on the scene with their formulated ideas and their opinions, their strong opinions, and they made this art that was explosive. And then as they started to deal with the reactions to that and comments, and they started soaking up other influences and stuff, it seemed to dilute that expression, that sort of vibrancy. And their work became a little vaguer or less exciting. Pairing that against the sort of the sponge who keeps soaking up things as he goes along, he or she, and makes, you know, work, and it's interesting, it's intriguing, and this person's exciting, and everybody's excited to see what he comes up with next, and he keeps working, and by the end of his life or his career, he's refined his thing to such a degree. I mean, I think Leonard Cohen, lyrically, was getting stronger and stronger and stronger as the music was getting weirder.
When you think of the music business, it's like the least forgiving of all the arts in terms of age versus youth. It's like, and probably is often the fault of the musicians themselves, who maybe try to stay young rather than writing to their age. But shouldn't it be that musicians should be able to have careers like Leonard Cohen, where they're still making relevant material into their 70s? But it seems like in music there's so many examples of, and I hate to say this because I love them, but, you know, the Rolling Stones have been a oldies act for the last couple decades now.
You know, those guys, they lost interest in being dangerous, you know? Like, that was sort of a fuel for a while. And that now the fuel is they're after having fun, you know? And that's totally commendable. There's nothing wrong with being creative for the sake of fun at all. But from our perspective, you know, one might be fascinating to watch and one might not, you know? And we can talk about these things with the assumed role, like the sort of self-placed role of feeling like it's like that art has a responsibility to interest people or entertain, I think is something that is just sort of taken for granted. And it's not. I mean, I think it's great to sometimes understand the origins of an artistic effort and react to it as such, you know, take it for what it is. Because you can always have some fantasy about how you imagine your favorite records came to be. You can have some depiction of what it must have smelled like in the studio.
Right.
But, you know, that's your own trip. That's your own fantasy that's your dream. It's not theirs. It's not even part of their record. I've played for some audiences that were just very, they felt very entitled, you know, sort of like a arms folded kind of thing. It baffles me. It's like, it's strange. It's like going to a party and then like behaving like, well, which one of you is going to entertain me? You know, who's going to make sure I'm having a good time? And it's up to you.
That's an interesting perspective. Because I think in a lot of ways, bands work very hard to create a certain vibe and a certain atmosphere, and then, yeah, an audience wants them to live up to that or keep giving them that thing.
Well, imagine how annoyed with me you would be if I asked you to continue telling the same story. Tell that story that you told me last time. Exactly. Oh, tell that again. Tell it to me again. I know, but just no, tell it like you told it, you know? It's like, don't change anything about it. Don't alter it. Don't like try to make the joke fresh. Just tell it exactly like you told it to me before. I mean, that's just to ask that of somebody is a little just a little presumptuous, I guess.
And it brings up a question that I have for you about playing live, which is obviously you don't want to go out and recreate the same thing over and over again once you've done it. And I wonder if you need the live experience, or would you be happy just creating in the studio and making records?
I wouldn't be satisfied with just sort of being indoors and making recordings all the time. And I've also found that trying to continue having a healthy dose of all the, you know, all those things, the touring, the traveling, the performing live, recording, writing, trying to keep all of those sort of aflame helps the things that, like, if I am in a zone where I really, really want to be spending more time in the studio, the time that I spend in the studio will be, the quality of it will be improved by just coming off of the road, you know, even after 2 weeks of not enjoying it, you know, as much as I had the 2 weeks before.
You need the dichotomy.
Yeah, I just need I really, it helps me write when I go and do sessions, and it helps me come up with ideas for what to do for the next show or who to call to try to get to play with by, you know, when I'm in the studio and just making something by myself. So they're catalysts, you know.
And also you're in a position now where you're a very in-demand session player and you're producing. And you're still in that place where I would think everything's new enough that it might be hard to say no, but can saying yes to everything be a dangerous thing to your own creative output or your own time?
Yeah. A friend of ours told me, like, the most difficult thing in this career is learning how to say no, not just saying it, but there's so many things and so many that I'd like to do, so many things that I'd like to say yes to, that I lessen the quality of, I think, what I could bring and what I have to offer by spreading myself too thin. In staying really busy, I've gotten to refine it, like figure out the fine print of what is going to be creatively draining, you know? And that's the affordability that I'm talking about. Like, I can't afford to drain myself creatively with things anymore, regardless of the payoff, you know?
So conversely, what's the criteria for saying yes to a new artist?
For saying yes to if somebody says, like, if there's something I'd never heard before and they...
Or even if it's just somebody, you know, whoever, Lucinda Williams or whoever, calls you and says, I want you to play on my record. What is kind of your criteria now for saying yes to a project and diving into someone else's record?
Well, I think the important thing is to make the distinction that if they have a strong idea of what they want, I'm quick at responding. I'm quick at reacting to something that I'm hearing and saying, you know, could sound great as this, or saying, this sounds really, really good, and I don't really want to mess with it, you know. But what, maybe it doesn't need guitar, but this weird little drum over here could sit really great. And it's just like sort of reacting and just posing thoughts, like the devil's advocate or something like that. That to me is a more rewarding use of my time. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of environments that I try to look for. And there's a lot of them, because there's a lot of people that write and then they get their song or their recording or something to a certain point, and then they don't really know, it doesn't feel complete, but they don't know where to take it. They don't know what else to do with it.
That's funny, because you describe that, and I could say, well, he's describing his job as a session player, but he's also describing his job as a producer. Are you finding that two are crossing over more?
They did. I mean, I was doing a lot of session work before I ever thought of producing, and I only thought to produce because I was being told that what I was doing was production. You know, when I was going in to do the session, that I was doing production work. And so I wanted to have more freedom to do that. And so I became interested in producing a record and just kind of having that role, you know, to experiment and to just go, okay, I don't have to feel bad if it's not an idea. I don't have to be timid in my suggestion of, you know, maybe you don't need drums on this. Maybe it's better without, you know. I don't want to bum out the drummer by having the guitar player that showed up be, you know, who wants to hear it. So,
was there a moment when that happened? Was there an awkward time where it's like, I got to say something because I know the song can be better, but I'm just the session guitar player?
It was never awkward. For better or worse, just say it, you know. And it may have been awkward to me, like, unbeknownst, awkward for other people, you know, and I just didn't pick up on it. But I've been in situations where it felt like there were some decisions being made, and I was just going, in my head, I was just going on and on, like, why, you know, like, what, how does that sound better, you know, than this? And then I realized, well, maybe they're not considering this. And so then I would just say, has anybody, you know, we were talking a second ago about learning how to say no and stuff, and it's important to phrase it in a way that isn't offensive, and just to say, has anybody heard it or considered it? You know, if you didn't have, let's say if you muted the drums, if you didn't have drums, if you did a version of it that didn't have percussion. And immediately the response is, you know, more oftentimes than not something like, oh, but we have to have drums because, you know, we hired Jim Keltner. You know, we have to have drums because I feel like live, you know, the people aren't going to, and it's just these reasons that don't really speak to anything other than that's like semantics or something, you know. It's but when I was doing session work, what was so great for me was that I knew it was not about me. And even doing the production work, it's even more so not about you. It's about the artist and about trying to help decipher what it is they're after and how to get to it, how to help them get to it. That there's somebody else in the room that ultimately needs to be pleased. The quickest way to do that, most effective, is to just try to please yourself, you know, to make sure that you're being moved by it, by what you're doing, by what you're hearing. Hoping that when you arrive at that pleasure, it's simultaneous and it's mutual. And when it's not, then it's important to recognize that, identify it, and step away, you know, and say, perhaps I'm not the guy, and perhaps, you know, I'm hearing it differently. And you either decide to just sort of bend over and do it like they want it, or you just say, you know, I know the perfect guy for this, and I'll give him a call. You know, thanks, but no thanks.
After doing this enough, I'm sure you start to get a sense of yourself and days that worked and days that didn't work. And I wonder if you've kind of identified some of your faults or weaknesses that you have to work around.
Well, that was a big one. I mean, the first thing that the first musical endeavor that I had was a band that I was a co-writer in. And so every decision, especially when you're 17, 18, 19 years old, you think every decision is going to come back to reflect you and what your artistic statement is or is going to be. You think every decision, like the font of the liner notes on the inside of the record. I mean, you put the magnifying glass on anything and it looks like it's going to be the most judged artistic statement that you'll ever make. And to unlearn that by leaving the band and being sort of an employee or a sideman or session or touring work was huge. Huge for me on a personal level, just to be able to work with people, being able to be less selfish, just in general. You know, that the art, working artistically, working creatively, helped me figure that out. You know, maybe it's more common for it to work around the other way, you know, that you kind of bring your personality into the art. But I feel like a large portion of who I am as a guy has come from the different roles that I've been allowed to pursue, you know, to play out. And for 5 or 6 years, that's been largely a supportive role. And I like that. I mean, I feel comfortable in that position. I like reacting to another player. I don't particularly respond to being the center. I don't really like leading a band. I don't really like being in the front singing. We were doing these tours where I'm the guitar player for the headliner, and I'll open. I'll do like an opening set to begin the night. And I enjoy it, but I'm always relieved once it's through, because I can look forward to the next hour and a half being in sort of what I think is a more natural role for me, which is to react, you know, and to be on the side and to be able to kind of listen, you know, while somebody is doing their thing, and then join in, you know, and back off and stuff. Not be in the hot seat where you can't break the momentum, or you feel like you can't break the momentum. You know, so I always sort of fantasize. I sit around and think about an environment, a show where it's like if I'm leading it, that I can just be sitting and I can be relaxed and I can break the narrative a couple times and turn to somebody else, and that the audience isn't going to lose their appetite, you know, because it's a little slower pace or it's a little less engaging or
right.
Something. You know what I mean? Like, that's why we do these sort of impromptu, informal things that a surf shop, is because nobody goes in there thinking like, nobody walks in there like they walk into Spaceland or the Troubadour with this air of like, well, how is this going to one up the last thing I saw? Or is this going to be my favorite show, my new favorite show?
Well, and you're speaking of Mollusk Surf Shop.
Yeah.
And, you know, it brings up, you do have a little very unique scene that happens there. And I don't even want to call it a scene, but it definitely doesn't have that. This is a show, and this is how you see a band, and like
yeah,
the semantics.
It's not
of
a
it.
Presentation, you
right.
know. So therefore, don't. It's like it's not a presentation. So don't worry about what you think of it. Don't worry about your own judgments of it or anybody else's.
Just be open to it.
And yeah, just go there. You know, go and or don't go. I mean, we don't invite people to it, really. We don't tell people about it. We don't make flyers. We don't charge. It's like send a few texts to friends because they might come down and play a few songs. Anybody else that shows up, it's just like, you know, it's word of mouth, and that's important to that kind of environment.
Is it that you're yearning for a spontaneous environment so things can happen, but you're not looking for an audience to, you know, come and be entertained?
Well, the premise of a show, just in its nature, is like you're putting something on display for others. And what's different about those nights at the surf shop is that what we're actually doing is just creating a sort of a positive environment for musicians to converse and be with each other, you know, to work on things with each other and have fun and play with people that they otherwise would never, you know, maybe have met up with, and just trying to pair unlikely musicians and writers together. So there's this circle of that going on. Outside the circle, there's sort of a voyeuristic environment. And what is sort of unspoken and what people seem to just naturally pick up, which I think is fantastic and kind of fascinating, is that they're conscientious of their ability to disturb that inner circle, to disturb the sort of petri dish, you know? And so the amount of respect that people have and appreciation for what they're witnessing is something you could not achieve, I don't think, at a venue, at a proper venue.
Is it different if you just gathered those same players and writers together in someone's living room?
Not for me, no. I mean, the difference, if the living room had the same dimensions, I mean, what's great about the shop is the size, and you some of, you know, the sounds can breathe and stuff, and it's beautiful inside. But no, I mean, it's kind of a sanctuary, you know, it is a living room aesthetic. Every time when I'm playing a song of mine, or when I'm singing or doing a song, I find myself looking down a lot and kind of tuning that the sort of gathering out and just sort of being with the players and the musicians and with my own thoughts. And then at the end, I kind of look up and sort of seem like come out of the water a little bit and reassociate myself with it. But when somebody else is playing, there's no break. When somebody else is playing, it's more of a realization of where we are and who's there and what's going on. I realize, like, when you go in there and you've had so many occasions that where incredible things have happened as a result of experimentation, that becomes an environment that encourages more experimentation.
You know, I was going to ask you to close this out. I was going to ask you if there was an era that you would have liked to have come of age in terms of when you think of all the great guitar players of the early 60s and the mid 60s, you know, that period where it seemed like there was just this flourishing of talent. But after hearing you talk about this, I feel really strongly that you're creating a very powerful thing for yourself. But is it valid to ask you if there was an era that you would have loved to have been around in the
turn of the century, when atonal music was coming about and people were freaking, you know, it was causing riots in the opera hall, you know, the auditoriums or whatever,
like Rite of Spring or something.
Yeah, that would have been pretty fascinating.
You know, I wouldn't have expected that answer.
That's more my scene than the Yardbirds, yeah. Maybe only because having 40 years of people doing pentatonic scales is enough for me to be, you know, reaching further back, you know, or further out there. So it might be kind of an impossible question, but, like, you know, without the abundance of blues guitar and kind of like hacky, you know, joyless noodling, as they refer to it lovingly as like guys, without that, I would be a completely different person, you know?
Seems like there's some stubborn desire to stir the pot in you, in your personality.
Sure. Yeah, I can admit to that much. And that's definitely, a lot of that stuff's been said, so I feel it's important to not be redundant, you know.
You say a lot of that's just been said. Like, where does that bring up the question? Like, where is left in the artistic world to drive a wedge in? Is that something to look for?
It's to be conscientious of. I think in the spirit of what we're talking about with those accidents and exploring those, you know, the. If that's your goal, I think you end up getting further away from it. If you're trying to discover what hasn't been said, because the only times for me that I feel like I've made a statement that was unique to myself was when I was just kind of going after what I enjoyed, rather than what I thought hadn't been done or seemed unfamiliar. And I've been guilty of that. I've definitely been guilty of sitting down and trying to go after You know, like, well, you know, what haven't, you know, what hasn't been, or what haven't I heard, or, but it's never as compelling. You know, the stuff I come up with when I'm after that, I forget about.
Can that only be understood in retrospect? Like, is there unexplored territory to find on the guitar? Well, we probably can't judge that when it's happening, right?
I mean, I don't know. People that saw Hendrix live knew at the time, you know, this is beyond, this is something other. When I first heard Derek Trucks, I mean, I knew that was the first time that the instrument had ever reached that level of expressivity, you know.
Is it daunting, though, 40 years later, to, you know, to ask yourself the question, is there anything more that can come out of this? Like, is there a new voice that can come along and find new places with it?
Yeah, no, but it just seems like a neutral technology. It seems like something that could be used to simply restate the obvious, you know, or something that can be used or misused to say something totally unfamiliar. I mean, just like anything else, it's just a matter of being in the hands of somebody who's either going to stumble across it or you know, just out of the design of who they are and that they're gonna reach something, you know, that in their search for something, they're gonna end up doing it differently than expected.
Yeah, you know, it's often in the failure to imitate that you find your own voice anyway.
Oh yeah,
with these cycles of imitation and then new branches sprout, I guess. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, what's next for you, Blake? Are you?
I've been writing, trying to kind of cap off a few songs that have been on the workbench for a while, in hopes of at the beginning of the next year getting in and beginning work on another record, another solo record, and continue co-writing with a few people for other various projects and production, and trying to get my hands on a space, like a studio, so that I can, without a goal, without a particular project in mind, just go into the studio to sort of allow for those accidents to happen. Just having a space that I can go in and live in and work in and record and document and kind of build up a reel, that really fascinates me. So I've been looking around to try to design that within my means, and hopefully have a bunch of recorded material by the end of next year.
Well,
to show for it.
Listen, I can't wait to hear it, and you know, I look forward to every little piece of music you do, and I'm so, you know, so fascinated to watch you work over these last couple of weeks, and also just to hear these stories behind what you've already done. And I hope that we can do this again when the next record comes out.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much, Blake.
Thanks, Sam.
You have just finished listening to another episode of Off Camera. To access more episodes, subscribe, and be a part of the entire Off Camera experience, please visit offcamera.com. This has been a presentation of the NTD Broadcast Network.